You're listening to Live Law, real stories about the law told live. I'm Nancy Mullane. This week's story is from Andrea James. Andrea was an advocate for prison reform, but when she found the roles flipped and she herself ended up behind bars, it changed how she saw things. Here's Andrea.
So I come to this whole criminal legal thing from like all these really interesting ways. And so I grew up in Roxbury, Massachusetts. So yeah, right? So my kids are the fourth generation to live in our home in Roxbury, Massachusetts. So in Boston, we were all, you know, the communities were separated by race, like seriously. We had a major, major race problem in Boston, Massachusetts. Like you couldn't come into Roxbury if you were white. And, you know, if you went to South Boston, they were going to beat you with hockey sticks. So it just wasn't something that we did. But one of the things that one of the only kind of upside to growing up in an extraordinarily racist city like that is that we lived in a community like Roxbury where we literally had rocket scientists, lawyers, doctors, everybody living together with people who were just like working on for Ford Motor Company or on the, you know, General Assembly lines, and people who didn't have employment, but all of the children in our community, in our neighborhood, were able to look up the street, down the street, and see somebody doing something that we could be interested in doing and know, you know what? I could possibly actually do that. So that was really great. And, you know, I come from a family that has really big shoes to fill, right? So my grandmother, my Nana, you know, she passed away at the age of 93, but my Nana broke the color barrier in nursing in the city of Boston. She was one of the first black nurses to gain entry. Yep, that's right. And the Canadian nurses wanted to jump her in the tunnel underneath Boston City Hospital, and she took off her cap and she says, you know, I can't beat you all at once, but I'll take you one at a time. And so we grew up hearing these stories from my Nana, right? And so her son, my uncle, was one of the premier labor lawyers in the country. He died prematurely of cancer while writing a legal textbook on ethics with Johnny Cochran. And then his wife, my Auntie Dee, was the first black lead pediatrician for L.A. County. So, yeah, and my mother and father are both educators, and they're 84 and 81 now, but we got to travel all over the world with them because they did research on people of African diaspora, and they marched in every march. I just took them a few years ago, the 50th anniversary, because Dad needed to be there again to celebrate having been there the first time. So coming from a family where when you walk in our house, we didn't have a whole lot of TV sets, but every single wall in the house had books like Black Like Me, and every kind of book written by any kind of black author in the world was on those walls. So I kind of grew up in the struggle. I kind of grew up hearing the conversations and falling asleep, you know, as a little kid under the table, and really being motivated to do social justice work from a very young age. And I got to go, I had the privilege, that word again, to attend a very elite private school in Milton, Massachusetts. And in that school, you know, I went there from my formative years on up, and then I, you know, there's a lot of drugs in those schools. And I happened to notice that a lot of the kids that I would get up every morning and I'd take three buses to get to this school, you know, were their older siblings would kind of like just disappear for a month or two. And, you know, they would just come back. And I mean, these kids were so wealthy that the names of the buildings on the campus were like named after their families. And so I also noticed at the same time, right around the time that I turned 13, 14, 15 years old, that my friends started spiraling into the juvenile system, and they were going to jail. And they were going there for stuff like in the presence of, which was a law that still exists in Massachusetts, that if you're in the presence of heroin, everybody on the block is going to jail. So, and these other kids, though, that I went to school with every single day, still came out. They ended up graduating from these very elite schools. They went on to Yale and Princeton and Harvard and all these other places. And my friends and family members went to jail. And so I became a lawyer. Because I was sitting in the, back then, you could actually go to the courthouse down in Dudley Square in Roxbury, and you could sit. They don't let the kids in the courthouse anymore, but you could sit and you could listen to the cases, and I would hear these really horrific, it was really all guys back then. And back then, the courthouse was really old, and they would bring all the guys in the van, and they'd be shackled and handcuffed, and they'd be doing the hop, and everybody trying to get up these stairs all at the same time without falling down on another. And all the women in the community, the mothers, the sisters, the girlfriends, the wives, the grandmothers, they'd all be standing at the top of the stairs, because back then they actually made courthouses where they brought all the guys that you had to walk by everybody to get up to the cells where they'd hold you till your case was called. So all these women would be standing there and they'd be yelling, "We're here." And the guys would be hopping and yelling and trying to see over the heads of everybody. And the mothers and the women would be trying to let the men know, "We're here. I'll send you some money. I'll do something. Tell so-and-so, send them this message, send them that message." So I would be in the courthouse, because usually one of my friend's brothers, who we adored, who we loved, who were our protectors, who did everything for us, taught us all the things we needed to know, made sure that those of us that were younger didn't follow in the footsteps and said, "You guys need to go to school. You're not in school. I'm going to be outside this school every single day, and you better be coming out of that school if they caught you playing hooky," right? So those guys, we would sit in the courtroom, we would hear these really horrific things said about them, right? So by the time I was 15 years old, I kind of just said, "You know what? That's not who he really is, and I want to do something about changing that story and doing something to contribute to keeping the people that I care about out of prison." So I became a lawyer, like I said, and prior to that, in college, I worked with, you know, all the young people in my community of Roxbury who were labeled as gang and gun involved, and then, you know, went to law school at Northeastern University School of Law, one of the best social justice law schools in the country. And that was a really, really, really great experience. Meanwhile, though, I am married to a man who did a 10-year, from Queens and Harlem, and he served a 10-year mandatory minimum drug sentence in the federal system. He had also done some time on the state side. But, you know, I realized really soon, even having that personal experience as a child, I started to realize what it was like also to be a parent and to be the loved one of somebody who was sent away, far away, to a federal prison, and what it's like for the children of somebody who's been sent far away to a federal prison all the way on the other side of the country and back and forth and crisscross all over the place until they finally settle the person down somewhere, how destructive that is to a family and how destructive that is to our children to try and stay connected to their father. And so in the meanwhile, I'm going to law school, and I finished law school and I started practicing law, and I cut my teeth at, you know, doing some work at the Public Defender Agency, and then went into private practice and spent my mornings and most of my days doing criminal defense work, which was incredibly frustrating, because you realize soon when you become a lawyer that that's not really the kind of work to do if you want to change stuff. So not that part of it anyway. And so just realizing that really soon, and then also was introduced to real estate conveyance law. So I really pretty much went from making no money as a public defender and a bar advocate in my early years of practicing law to making gobs of money for years as I developed my real estate conveyance practice. And then predatory lending moved very swiftly into our community. And like I told you, my kids are the fourth generation to live in our home in Roxbury. When you take a home from one of the families in Southie or Charlestown or Dorchester or Roxbury, you're taking the livelihood away from entire families for generations. So we decided to do something about it, and it wasn't necessarily legal. And so for a little bit of time, and I won't go into great detail, we tried to do something about it kind of in an underground way. And that landed me in federal prison. And so I now had kind of like this big full circle of my experience with the criminal legal system, because now I was going into federal prison as an incarcerated woman. And I have to tell you something. After, by then, it had been 22 years of doing nothing from the time I was in college to that time that I entered the federal prison for women in Danbury, Connecticut as an incarcerated woman. I didn't think there was anybody that could tell me anything more about how broken our criminal legal system is, until I left my five-month-old baby boy in the parking lot of the prison and my 12-year-old daughter, and we had older children that were all there who brought me to drop me off at the prison because I was a lawyer and we're treated differently, and I was able to self-surrender. But when I walked into that prison and looked across a sea of women, of black women, it was heartbreaking. And when I stayed in that prison for 2 years and I met sisters that had been there for 15, 17, 18 years and still had another 10 years to go, and they had been separated from their children, and the last time they laid eyes on their children was looking out the back of a police car after a drug raid, and that was 6, 7, 8 years ago. Some of them had no idea where their children were. And what that experience was like and how terrible we have done in this country in letting us get to a place where we can take women from their children and throw them in a federal prison or any prison in this country and shut the door and pretend that it doesn't matter. We have become a sick, sick country. So we started our organization, Families for Justice is Healing, in the prison yard, sitting around a picnic table, one brutally hot day in Danbury, Connecticut. And when I came home 3 years ago, just got off paper, woohoo! When I came home, I brought the organization out with me, and right now that's what we do. We organize formerly incarcerated women, because I gotta tell you something, we might think we're the professionals, we are not the experts. So until we get formerly incarcerated people and formerly incarcerated women taking the lead on creating change in this criminal legal system and just the systems that are controlling our lives in general, until that lead comes from the people that have been most impacted, we will never make the change that needs to happen. Thank you.
Andrea James told her story at a recent Live Law show in Baltimore. Be sure to check out our sister podcast, Life of the Law, featuring investigative reports on the law in our lives, next week on Life of the Law.
This project says that there aren't two distinct categories of human beings. There aren't these two mutually exclusive boxes of clean and criminal. But rather, we're all human, and we've all violated the law, and we all deserve that second chance.
That's next week on Life of the Law. You can hear our feature reports and our live law stories by visiting our website, lifeofthelaw.org. This episode of Live Law was produced by Mary Adkins and Jonathan Hirsch. I'm Nancy Mullane. Thanks for listening.